expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guest do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
The Paranormal View. The Paranormal View. The Paranormal View.
You are about to enter a world that's not new. A world that will inspire you with pondering to do. A world known only as the Paranormal View.
Time now for the Paranormal View.
The Paranormal View. From the Para-X Radio Network, the Paranormal View.
And welcome, everybody, to the Paranormal View right here on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. For those here in the chat room, we appreciate each and every one of you. My tongue ain't working tonight. And those that are listening from around the world, we appreciate you also. And if you're not with us here in the chat room, feel free to come on over, para-x.com. Click on the live chat button, and you'll be in with all these wonderful people. You'll be able to interact with the people in the chat room and with us by sending us private messages with questions for our guest. We're a little late getting on tonight. I was having problems with Skype, but now we should be going real good. So we have with us Cat Cloco.
Happy 12, 13, 14 today.
Yeah.
And
we have Barbara Duncan.
I'm here.
I don't know if I am or not. And we have Jeffrey Gould.
Hello, hello.
Tonight we got a great guest with us, and since we were a few minutes late getting on, I'm going to let Jeff just go ahead and introduce our guest.
Yes, well, our guest tonight is Michael J. Varhola, who's a freelance journalist. Oh my God, can you hear me? I'm hearing like...
No?
I can hear you.
Yeah.
We can hear you, Jeff.
From my headsets, it sounds like wind machine is going through.
Power through it!
Exactly. I'll just ignore it and just say the lines. Michael J. Varhola is a freelance journalist, public speaker, author, and co-author of numerous books and innumerable articles, publishers of several publications, veteran of the U.S. Army. And currently, Michael serves as publisher of Skirmisher Publishing, LLC, and editor-in-chief of Skirmisher Online Gaming Magazine. Michael has launched and run several websites, such as Living History Online, KoreanWar.net, and Skirmisher Online Gaming Magazine. And in addition to writing, Varhola regularly speaks and gives presentations on his areas of specialization, particularly ghost hunting, the war between the states, shipwrecks, wargaming, and publishing. So welcome, Michael Varhola.
Thank you. And, you know, next time I'm going to be on the Paranormal View, I need to send you my updated biography, because some of that stuff I still don't have in the works right now. The Korean War stuff, I haven't done that for a few years, because nobody cares about the Korean War anymore. I still do, but not enough people for me to actually do anything about it. In addition to that, and what's probably most relevant to anyone who's listening, is that I'm also the editor of the America's Haunted Road Trip series of travel guides to haunted places that people can visit. So that is one of the big things that I'm involved with right now.
Yes, you are. You took over for John Kachuba, right?
That's right. Yes, sir. That is correct.
Yeah. I just seen him a month or so ago down at a big event in Cincinnati. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, was that the Something of Light?
Victory of Light.
That's right. Yeah. Well, he lives in that area, too. Yeah, yeah. He's a great guy. He and I guess, have had different visions for the series. He's a big set of shoes to try to follow in the footsteps of.
Now, yeah. Tonight, we're going to be talking about one of the books that's not yet out, is it?
No. If you are talking about ghost hunting, San Antonio, Austin, and Texas Hill Country. It is not yet out. I am down to working on the last five chapters of it. So we are really down to the wire on it. I've written half of two chapters that still need to be written, and I need to start three others. But I get done with five chapters. I hope to have them off within the next week to the publisher, and we're looking at the book coming out sometime between March and May, and once I get them the last of the chapters, they'll stop being obtuse and actually tell me when they're planning on coming out with the thing.
Huh. Well, at least you have it in with the editor. Oh wait,
he's a great guy and he's really easy to work with. So yeah.
Wow.
Oh, make now, sure he gives you a raise.
I'd like it if he could do that.
Now I want to remind everybody that if you do have questions for Michael, you can private chat your mess or your questions to either Ceiling Cat, Cat Perview, Jeffrey Gould, or myself, and we will get those questions right over to Michael. Now there's a lot of history, not only just history, but also locations in the Southwest Texas.
Yeah.
That has hauntings and ghosts and spirits and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the Southwest is unique in the country in a lot of ways. It has, I mean, obviously for those of us who live here, these are more familiar things. But we have the history of Spanish settlement here. While people were just building, you know, mud huts in Virginia and New England, you actually had walled towns and monastery complexes here in the Southwest. Santa Fe was a full-blown city when the first pioneers encountered it. So yeah, we've got a unique history that includes conquistadors and Indians and battles that were fought before really the Southwest was even on the radar for the rest of the country. So there's just a whole unique, colorful, different spin on ghost hunting and haunted places and our haunted lore down here.
All right. Now, I know one of the, you give us a few things to look at and to where we can might have some questions for you. One of the things that you talk about is one of the most haunted is the Crockett Hotel. Naturally, it would be after Davy Crockett.
Mm-hmm.
What all is supposed to be going on there, and what about some history with that hotel?
Well, there's something. Let me explain all this. The very center of San Antonio, the spiritual center and the geographical center, is the remains of the Alamo. And everybody's heard of the Alamo, but what people don't necessarily realize are a couple of things. One, that the Alamo was one of a half dozen mission complexes that were located along the San Antonio River. And were founded starting in the early 18th century, in the early 1700s. And these were founded for a couple of reasons. One was to help establish political and military control over the area for Spain, because what we now know as Texas was a colony of Spain in that era. And another was to spread Christianity in general, Catholicism in particular, and to convert the Indians. So these missions would be run by a couple of dozen clergy who would then have 300 or 400 Indians living on the mission, and they would teach them agricultural practices and convert them, not just in a religious point of view, but in a cultural point of view, from nomadic peoples to sedentary peoples. So what we know as the Alamo is the remains of one of those half dozen missions that was founded in the area that we now know as San Antonio. The other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of times people will visit the Alamo and they'll say, well, it's smaller than I expected it to be. It's smaller. Well, what they're seeing is just the chapel. originally what we know of as the Alamo was a huge complex. It would have been, you know, probably a couple of hundred acres. And most of the buildings in central downtown San Antonio, right in the vicinity of the Alamo, were originally part on land that was part of the Mission Complex. So the Crockett Hotel was at one corner. It's built on what was one corner of the Alamo Mission. And that was the corner. That was the corner that where the last fierce battle of the siege of the Alamo was fought out, and where David Crockett and the last defenders of the Alamo are believed to have been killed. Also on that spot, it's believed that many of their bodies were burned. That Crockett was burned on the spot, pretty much where he was slain. So the Crockett Hotel is built on land that used to be part of the Alamo Mission, and where David Crockett and the final Alamo defenders died fighting Santa Anna's troops in the Battle of the Alamo in 1836, and where he was burned, and where his spirit, where his shade, his ghost, and those of others have subsequently been seen. So that is the history of the Alamo and the land around it, and why the Crockett Hotel is haunted and why it's named for David Crockett.
Now, I'm curious, was there a significance to burning the bodies as to burying them?
Yeah, there was. That was part of Santa Anna's wrath. That was part of his an extension of his no-quarter policy with the Texians, the Texas Revolutionaries, who were fighting for Texas independence. So most of them would have wanted to have been buried in a place where their families could visit their graves, or where the Texas cause could use them to memorialize them and use them as a magnet for further resistance against the Mexicans. They were Mexicans and not Spanish at that point. So the idea was to completely destroy them, to expunge them from the earth, so that they there would be no trace of them, and that would be part of their punishment for opposing Mexican rule and Santa Anna.
Wow, that is brutal. Yeah, I know from the California missions that were out here, those missions were rather harsh, especially in their treatment of Native Americans. And I'm sure that translated over to the Texas missions as well.
Yeah, it did. And you know, it's just so much in vogue to beat up religion and the church, and I really don't want to do that. I think it was brutal. I don't think it was the intent of the missionaries to be brutal. I guess that's what I would say, that these weren't inherently sadistic people. They weren't trying to be brutal to the Indians, but you know, they saw some guy running around with his pants off, you know, hunting rabbits or knocking pecans out of a tree, and it just set them off. But you know, it set off modern Texas today. I think it was brutal. It was inherently brutal. The whole idea that your whole lifestyle would be changed overnight, and I think a lot of the reason so many Indians put up with it is because it's easy to romanticize a nomadic lifestyle.
Sure.
But nomadic peoples have their stomachs empty a lot of the time. You know, they don't have any means of storing food, and there are lean months, especially in the winter. So I think it was kind of a trade-off. You know, they were willing to live in the monastery complexes and put up with the rules that were imposed there because they had full stomachs. They gave up a lot and they lost a lot. And what happened was, once the Indians had a lot of those skills that they needed, they drifted away from the monasteries. So within about 100 years of them being founded, they were all secularized. Two things that happened. One, a lot of the Indians just left. So instead of there being 300 or 400 Indians at the monasteries along the banks of the San Antonio River, there might have only been 30 or 40. So they didn't have the big populations that they had had previously, because a lot of the Indians had just decided that you know, they could make their own way in the world one way or another without the monasteries. And then the greed of the local Spanish and then Mexican secular authorities sort of won out. And at a point when the church had waned in influence, Spain ended up seizing the monastery properties, secularizing them, giving out the land to people that they wanted to curry favor with or selling it off to raise revenue. So really, the monastery complexes and their thousands of acres of land got shrunken down to just very, very small areas that had a lot less influence. So by the time of the Texas Revolution in the 1830s, the monasteries really only existed in a vestigial form.
Yeah, I was just thinking, well, even in the monastery time at that point, the treatment of even the monks and the friars that were there was pretty harsh as well. It was just at the level the Catholic Church was at the moment.
Well, and so, a lot of it's that they were living on a frontier, too.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
it would be
sure.
Sort of like if, you know, all of us just packed up and went off and lived on a moon colony. Just inherently, there it's going to be on an austere, grim existence.
Extremely,
yeah. Yeah, so I think that was a lot of it as well. And the conquistadors were certainly brutal. Those were the two conflicts that the monasteries you know, had to deal with. One, they were trying to save souls, but on the other hand, the soldiers that had been sent over from Spain were looking for gold, or gathering slaves and selling them to work big plantations. There were a lot of competing factors going on as well. But those kinds of tensions and those kinds of emotions and all of the suffering and grief and bloodshed that took place around these monasteries, this is what's contributed to all of them being extremely haunted. And people can visit them. People only know about the Alamo. But there are four other monasteries that are still in existence right in San Antonio, just a few miles from the Alamo, that people can visit and
wow.
investigate.
So with a lot of these old monasteries, is there a variety of hauntings that are reported then?
Yeah, sure. There's a variety of hauntings. There's one, for example, Mission San Juan, which is the southernmost one, is mm-hmm. considered by many people to be the most haunted.
Okay.
You know, some of them, there'll be things that people encounter that really seem like what are often called shadow people.
Right.
Somebody has described something that really seems demonic, some sort of a presence that manifests itself out of smoke. But most of them tie in one way or another with the era of when they were active monasteries. So they somehow involve Indians or conquistadors or friars or something mm-hmm. along those lines. And what's interesting, though, is the famous San Antonio ghost tracks, and I suspect most people have heard at least some reference to the ghost tracks. Those are actually located on what used to be monastery land down by Mission San Juan. So I think it's significant and interesting that one of the most famous haunted places in San Antonio is actually located on what used to be monastery land, and most people don't know that.
Wow.
Now, so the monasteries are integral to the haunted history of San Antonio. And they're not the only things I covered. They're not the only things worth investigating. But they are, you come back to them just again and again.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, have you had a chance to go to all these places? And
oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Have you been able to investigate any of them?
Well, yes and no. It all depends what you mean by an investigation. At the very least, when I go somewhere, I'm taking pictures. I'm running a micro cassette recorder. Okay. I'm interviewing people. So everywhere I go, if I'm going to take the time to go there, I'm doing at least a rudimentary investigation. I'm doing at least a mini investigation. I'm at least interviewing other people who have done investigations of some kind at the site. So yeah, if I'm going somewhere, I'm doing it with an eye to probing its haunted history.
That's good.
That's and material history too, because I think I think they're both related.
Now, right.
I do have some questions from the chat room. Caroline wanted to know, do you deal with UFOs?
What do I deal with UFOs? I guess, without knowing exactly what she means, the answer is yes and no. The no part is that I don't really, I'm not really a ufologist per se, but there has been some crossover with that sort of thing with other things that I've done. I've been out to Area 51 a couple of times. I've written a couple of articles on Area 51. I've interviewed some of the people that hang around at the Little Alien, which is the watering hole in Rachel, Nevada, right outside the gates of Area 51. So it's something that I have done. And I think I'm trying to collect my thoughts here. I don't like the phrase ghost hunter for a number of reasons. And the main reason I don't like the phrase ghost hunter is because it implies that when you're setting out on an investigation, that you already know what you're going to be investigating. Mm-hmm. And I think that really, really limits the possibilities of what you might discover or what you might be dealing with. And I believe in the supernatural, and I believe in the existence of ghosts. I don't believe they pop up everywhere or as often as people say, but I do believe these things are real. And I believe there's a lot that we can't necessarily quantify or explain. So when I go out to investigate something, I don't go out looking for ghosts. I go out looking to explain or learn what's going on at that site. So that makes me a paranormal investigator. So I prefer the phrase paranormal investigator because what I might discover is something that ties in with aliens or UFOs. Usually not, but, you know, that's a possibility. Or might tie in with some sort of elemental or demonic presence. Or might, in fact, as is quite often the case, tie in with ghosts. So, you know, in answer to the question, am I involved with UFOs at all? Yes, I am, because that's something I've written about and published on and personally, you know, done some pilgrimages in support of, and that's also something that I acknowledge the possibility and existence of whenever I'm doing another kind of investigation.
So the movies Cowboys and Aliens could actually be a documentary.
It sure could be, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So now, you're in the area where there is, well, especially in the Southwest with the Hopi Indians, the other tribes that are there, there's a lot of shamanic practice within the Native American community. Do you find that you're in contact with more elemental type of energy?
You know, sometimes I think that's what you're dealing with. There's a wonderful site that I write about in Ghost Hunting San Antonio called Enchanted Rock, and it's this pink granite dome. And when I say that it's big, it's a 600-acre granite dome. That's the surface area. So it's an immense granite dome, pink granite dome. And the Indians, the Comanche and Apache, considered it to be a sacred site. And it's very possible that there are ghosts associated with that site, the ghosts of people who died on or around the rock. But most of the stories associated with it really make it sound like a portal to the other world. Really involve things that sound more like spirits as opposed to ghosts or the spirits of departed people. So yeah, you do get quite a bit of that. Probably everyone who's listening is sort of the Riverwalk. This is like this park area that goes through San Antonio, and it's got parks and restaurants. It's a beautiful area. It's I think the biggest tourist attraction in San Antonio, maybe short of the Alamo. But people have encountered all sorts of things there, including fish that talk to them. Well, that doesn't present as a ghost to me. That really seems more like, and I know fish have talked to me there, so I can't vouch for any of these experiences. I'm just recounting some of the things that I've learned, that I've heard from people. But that sort of thing really feels much, much more to me like some sort of a natural or elemental spirit than a ghost per se. And you know, that goes to what I was saying. If you go looking for ghosts, you're going to find ghosts. If you go looking for explanations, you're going to find all sorts of different things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember seeing a movie where a fish talked.
Sure, it happens.
Yeah.
and of course, you know, there's always lawyers because they're bottom feeders.
The fish are probably just carping about the weather.
Exactly. Oh. They're not being coy. They're not being coy at all.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's a slow clap right there, guys. Yeah, Enchanted Rock reminds me a lot of the Serpent Mound here in Ohio. We have a lot of people who have seen visions of the Native American tribes that lived in the area, but more of a portal thing. And the funny thing is, we also have a lot of UFO sightings around these mound areas.
Mm-hmm.
Including Cincinnati, where I'm in, we still have some of these mounds. There's one in Norwood, less than 5 miles from my house, and there are UFOs sighted around here.
Yep. Yeah, and that's all that old Mississippian culture. Yeah. And my understanding is there was something like 2,000 town-sized sites identified with this culture throughout the country, along the Mississippi and Ohio and other tributary rivers. We don't have any of that right around where I live. I don't think any of that's been found around the San Antonio River. Mm-hmm. These were nomadic peoples here. But if you go a bit further east of where I'm at, and in Arkansas, I visited some of the Moundsville types. And then I've been to Serpent Mound in Ohio, and you know, Cahokia in East St. Louis, and those are all things that I've investigated as well. So yeah, that's absolutely fascinating, and it really goes against a lot of what we learn about North American history and Native American history when I was growing up.
Yeah, it's something that's really largely left out, at least with my education in Indiana. It was just like, yeah, we got these mounds, and they're there. Yeah. It's like, well, why are they there? There's no explanation.
Exactly.
And the rock is a labyrinth, right? The Enchanted Rock has a labyrinth underneath it?
It does, yeah. Yeah, it has some passages and caves, and I haven't been too far into them. I've got some pictures of the website I actually sent you. My website that's dedicated to ghost hunting San Antonio, Austin, and Texas Hill Country. I've got some pictures of some of the tunnels underneath that. So that's something I've got to get back and experience in a bit more depth. I was actually chaperoning a school group when I went there. So I had to both get as far into the passageways as I could and keep the kids from coming in at the same time. So that was sort of working at cross purposes with each other.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking it's kind of similar to in Greece when you would go to the Delphi Oracle. You would be underground for a period of time actually did that. And I think mm-hmm. there's a couple of other places, if you believe that some of the Nordic and Celtic groups also had mazes that you would travel through the dark. So it's very, very similar to that. I don't know what this was actually used for ceremonial-wise, but it would be interesting to know.
Well, I think areas like that are perceived as being a gateway to the netherworld, the other world. The ancient Greeks, you're talking about the ancient Greeks, they considered underground areas, deep caverns, as being entrances to the underworld. And anytime any sort of gas or vapor was coming up from places like that, they called it the breath of Hades. They actually referred to it as the breath of Hades, the god of the underworld. So areas like that were literally seen. The Aztecs believed exactly the same thing as the Greeks did, more or less. Their concept of the netherworld might not have been exactly the same, but they perceived these caves, these entrances. In Mexico and Guatemala, you have these cenotes, these sinkholes. So you'll have a jungled area with a big sinkhole with a lake in the middle of it, and then caves headed off in every direction. And the Aztecs saw those as entrances to the underworld. So when you have an area that's a natural entrance, people are seeing it as the entrance to the other world. And then when somebody actually builds something that mimics that, well, it's a ritual area that is supposed to be a parallel, a metaphor for the other world.
It was also used as sacrificial areas, was it not?
Yeah, I remember
Mayan,
a lot of this.
Yeah, in the Mayan culture. Yeah,
they have artifacts all over the bottom of that, of the sinkholes in the Mayan areas. Because I remember when I visited Chichen Itza, we visited also a sinkhole, and they found feet, just, I can't remember how many feet, 10, 15 feet of layered offerings.
Yeah.
Bones. But you had humans were thrown into them, but they also threw gold and other types of artifacts into these sinkholes too.
Yeah, so. The cenotes, they're fascinating. And they're sort of an under-explored type thing as well.
Yeah. Oh, they're hard to explore.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's just one of those things that we don't necessarily hear as much about as we'd like to. You know, it's sort of one of those unexplored history type things. I actually spent the entire month of August, by the way, in the Aegean, visiting historic sites and doing paranormal investigation and working on a number of projects. So I was in Athens just a couple of days, but then Crete, and Santorini, a volcanic island called Enceros, Rhodes, and Kos. So I spent a total of almost 28, 29 days in the Aegean exploring sites. So a lot of what you're saying really resonates with me.
That would be pretty interesting, going to places like that where there's so much history and everything, that you'd almost expect to be able to get some sort of EVPs and other different things. Yeah.
It is just so fascinating. I mean, a friend of mine and I were on an island called Kos, and Kos is just literally 2.5 miles off the Turkish coastline. So it's extremely far east. As you can be in Greece. It's almost to the Asian mainland. And we rented an ATV and took it as far up into the hills as we could go on this island of Kos. And once we had taken the ATV as far as it could go, we hiked on foot up to this ruined village. And actually, if you look at the picture of me that you posted with the little promotional thing you did for the show, that's me peeking out of the window of a ruined hut, of a little stone hut up in this village that was on this little saddle in the hills. But then at the peak of this hill, the very top thing that we were able to hike up to was the ruins of a small fortification where people still tell the story. This is amazing. People still tell the story of how when Hercules, or Heracles in the Greek tradition, when his ship wrecked on the shores of Kos, and he ended up battling one of the local tribes, he had to flee, and he fled up to this castle and took refuge in this castle for an indefinite period of time. And just the idea that, you know, we could venture up into the hills and with enough effort go up to and spend the day in a place that if Hercules was a real person, he had spent time there. You know, we think of Hercules as, you know, just sort of this buffoon in kids' stories. You know, we go back to the Kevin Sorbo image, but he was a real, vital character in Greek mythology. He was an archetype. He was someone that you know, people really looked up to for his qualities and saw their own imperfections in as well. And being able to go to a place where he is believed to have been, where I believe he was, it's almost an ineffable experience. It's just so sublime and special to be able to do something like that.
Yeah, it's like walking the battlefields of Gettysburg, just knowing all those soldiers had been out there fighting. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
I think what we're going to do is go ahead and take our first break, give everybody a chance to relax for a second. And
yeah, sorry, I don't help people relax. I apologize. I just stay ramped up when I'm talking about this stuff.
We'll give you a chance to bring you something to drink or whatever. We'll take
more coffee.
Yeah, that's good. We'll take a 6-7 minute break. Just remember, mics are live, so either just mute it or don't talk. And we'll be back in about 6-7 minutes. We'll let Kat take us out, and Cece will bring us back.
Okay, everyone, you are listening to The Paranormal View with your hosts Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Kat Kloko. Tonight's guest is Michael Overhaulo. Varhola, thank you. Uh-huh. Author of America's Haunted Road Trip, Ghost Hunting San Antonio, Austin, and the Texas Hill Country by Clear Sea Press, plus much, much more. And there is more to come after the break.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk-time stroll down the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
Hi, I'm Rosalyn Bown, and you are listening to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.
Ghost Hunters Case Log 451. The time? Thursday, 8 p.m. Okay, we're going to start an EVP session. Is there anyone out there? Can you repeat that? I really need you to try to project louder and slower so we can all hear.
The Black Cat Lounge.
That's right, gang. Listen in, the Black Cat Lounge, every Thursday night, 8 o'clock, on Para X.
Whether you need help putting together your event, looking for a celebrity, or just want to pump up the excitement, look no further than Ideal Event Management. Ideal Event Management is a top-rated paranormal events organizer. They also represent some of the biggest names and personalities in the paranormal community. Contact Mark at 413-478-3642 or check out their website at idealeventmanagement.com.
So, you had a lucid dream about living in Atlantis, teaching telepathy, and you're wondering what it means. We can actually help. We are the School of Metaphysics. A 40-year-old international resource for people who have questions. Big, juicy, deep questions about life and death and everything in between. 16 branches in the U.S., self-guided study online, weekend courses, webinars, and books. Send us a telepathic fax or visit our website, www.som.org. This could be the start of something really interesting.
Hi, I'm Eric Beebe, owner of Postmortem Press, independent press outside the lines. And I'd like to invite you, the paranormal community, to check out our website, www.postmortem-press.com. We are currently looking for nonfiction paranormal books. Tell me about your hauntings. Tell me about haunted locations, experiences that you've had in unusual places, anything in the paranormal. this is an area that we would really like to explore, and maybe what you have to say is something we'd like to share with the world. So you can check us out again at postmortempress.com.
Hi, this is Hollywood Hunt writer Marla Brooks, and you're listening to the Para X Radio Network.
You know, there's nothing like a great memory of a great time. And if you grew up during the 1950s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, boy, have we got the memories for you. There was no time more innocent than the 1950s or 60s, nor was there a time more politically explosive. Hi, this is Steve Shockley, a.k.a. The Shock. Join me live every Friday and Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern for a Baby Boomer Rock with a Shock Sock Hop on Rock with a Shock Radio.com.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal. Para X.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal View here on Parex Radio. We want to thank everybody for joining us tonight with our wonderful guest, Michael Verhulda, author of Ghost Hunting San Antonio, Texas, and Texas Hill Country, and Austin. We can't forget that, too. Michael, we start talking about Texas, what has so many layers of history to it, and I think it's nice that the United States finally starting to get the same layers as Europe did, because we're not just talking now of the early settlers and invaders of Texas, but also the what came later, which was the cattle drives, the hotels, the gambling, the faro tables, the gunfights. And the Menger Hotel strikes me as being probably one of the centers of that, correct?
Oh, yeah. Menger Hotel for sure is haunted.
And was it simply always a hotel, or was it, I mean, I'm sure there were brothels down there, too. There must have been.
Yeah, sure. As a matter of fact, San Antonio, I don't know that Menger was ever a brothel. I've never heard anything like that, and I've researched its history, you know, pretty extensively. The Menger was on the site of a brewery originally, so that's what was originally on that site. So one of the first breweries, maybe the first, breweries in Texas, and certainly the first in San Antonio, was located on that site. And its cellar was originally constructed as a way of storing beer and keeping it cool. So that's part of its history. But no, there was actually a red light district in San Antonio that was pretty much ignored by the local authorities right up until about World War II. Well, not about World War II, it was World War II. And essentially, the federal government exerted pressure to have it shut down and to have the locals begin enforcing against it because they didn't want soldiers and airmen who were in San Antonio availing themselves of it. So it was really a military issue and federal intervention that led the red light district to being shut down. And that's really true throughout a lot of Texas. The Bunny Ranch, Chicken Ranch. Chicken Ranch in what is the name? It's the one that ZZ Top used to sing about, LaGrange. It's the Chicken Ranch in LaGrange. That didn't get shut down until the 1970s. There was a brothel in San Angelo where there was an Air Force base. That didn't get shut down until the 1950s. So this was really something that was permitted in Texas, especially South Texas, right up until modern times, and it really took federal intervention to get them shut down.
That's amazing.
Yeah, very much so. And if you go to San Angelo, there's actually a terrific brothel tour. And it's family-friendly, as family-friendly as a brothel tour can be. But there is one of the original brothels that was there is now a museum. It's a brothel museum, and it's a lot of fun.
Wow. Now, I don't think Faro was founded there. I know that there was a lot of Faro tables going on down the cattle drive, which I think ended in San Antonio, did it not?
San Antonio, yeah. Well, it depends which trail you're talking about. So the Chisholm Trail was one that picked up in this area and then ran along the Devil's Backbone, which is a haunted highway just 6 miles from my house, and one that I've investigated any number of times and written about quite extensively. It was the first place, haunted place I ever wrote about when I moved to Texas 5.5 years ago, nearly 6 years ago. Cattle will run from San Antonio up across the Devil's Backbone north into the stockyards of Kansas.
Yeah. You might want to explain to folks the Devil's Backbone?
Yeah.
Apart from the Guillermo del Toro movie, I guess.
Well, that was set in Spain anyway. That was a village set in Spain. Yeah, there's a I live in a county called Comal County, and the county to the north is Hays County. And if you look at a map, there's sort of the county line is sort of a 45-degree angle, sort of a wiggly 45-degree angle. And that's because the line is formed by this ridge of mountains just north of me, and the ridge of mountains, low mountains, I'm in Texas Hill Country, so they look more like what you call hills than mountains, but this particularly rugged ridge that drops off into valleys and ravines and dry stream beds in every direction is known in the local area as the Devil's Backbone, and it has a reputation for being extremely haunted. Matter of fact, there was an author who wrote at least half dozen books that were just about ghost stories associated with the Devil's Backbone. So the ridge of the Devil's Backbone is something the cattle used to get run along. People have claimed that the James Gang, when they hid out in Texas, hid out in some of the valleys off of the Devil's Backbone, and that their ghosts are sometimes spotted. There are any number of legends about abandoned Spanish gold mines that are hidden in the valleys and ravines off of the Devil's Backbone. As a matter of fact, just a couple hundred yards from where I'm standing now, and I'm in my office at my house, just a couple hundred yards away, the ground drops off. I live on a ridgeline, and the ground drops off into the Devil's Hollow. And the Devil's Hollow is a heavily wooded ravine that flows off of the Devil's Backbone. So the Devil's Backbone runs pretty much east-west, and then the Devil's Hollow goes from north to south, and when water flows through it, it empties into the Guadalupe River. And it is a haunted ravine that the cowboys used to be considered to be pretty ominous. And when a calf went down into the Devil's Hollow, it wasn't always followed, especially if it was near dusk. And I've been down there and experienced weird things at twilight. This is the Devil's Backbone is essentially a haunted ridgeline that is now co-equivalent with a haunted highway, RR 32, Rural Route 32.
So wait, you opened a whole bit of a worm there. what experiences in twilight did you experience?
Well, I've seen things down there. I've heard things. And people say, well, you know, can you really prove that you've heard or seen these things? No, I can't, but I'm not in the business of proving things to people. I'm in the business of, investigating things and reporting on them as even-handedly as I can. Just little things, not as the most profound things I've ever experienced. I was standing in a meadow down in the Devil's Hollow once, a little meadow surrounded by juniper trees, and I heard a bell chime in my ear, like a dog bell, like something that would be on an animal's collar. I mean, it was right there. It was right next to me, right next to my my head. I heard this bell chime, and I turned, and there wasn't anything there. But on another occasion, I found a bell, an actual old bell that would have been of the sort that hung around the neck of a cow, probably, because cattle used to get run through there when I was down in the Devil's Hollow. So just little things like that. Nothing overly profound, no full figure apparitions or anything like that, but just a sense that it is, in fact, as haunted as people say it is.
Now, I know that there's quite a few hotels in the area, old ones, and some of them used to be hospitals. But
that's correct. Emily Morgan Hotel used to be a hospital.
Right.
Well, yeah,
you had some pictures in there of some of the hotels that looked fairly nice. The Ye Kendall Inn.
That's beautiful. Yeah, Ye Kendall Inn is out in Burning. That's B-O-E-R-N-E, Burning. And it's beautiful. Yeah, that dates back to the mid-19th century. I think the central portion of it was built in about 1850 or thereabouts, and it was built as a private home. And then by the 1880s, it was being used as a stagecoach stop. And then around that era, the 1880s, it was expanded, had a couple of wings put on it, and it was actually, at that point, diverted over to full-time use as a hotel. And that name, Ye Kendall Inn, goes back to the 1880s, and it was named for Kendall County, where it's at, or more specifically, for the man for whom Kendall County is named. But what's really interesting about Ye Kendall Inn is not just that it's pretty coolly haunted, but I love hotels. I love hotels because they're very user-friendly for paranormal investigators. I mean, basically, if you want to conduct a paranormal investigation, all you have to do is check in for the night. And if it's also a historic hotel and also a beautiful hotel, then you can't lose. I mean, it's a winning proposition. At the very least, you have a fun stay in a beautiful property and get to experience that. And at the other end of the spectrum, you might actually experience something more. So that's hotels in general. But you Kendall Inn is kind of special because they have a dozen cottages and cabins that are located in an area behind the hotel, and these are cottages and cabins, historical cottages and cabins, some of them a couple hundred years old, that have been brought there from around the state of Texas. So from the point of view of a ghost hunter, it's actually amazing not just to have this haunted hotel, this big, beautiful limestone block building, but then behind it to actually find a dozen cottages, cabins, and one church with their own histories that have been brought from around the state. So it's really an incredible and neat place to visit and to try to conduct an investigation.
So
I'm sure what's cool about having a hotel that's so open to investigations that instead of putting a mint on their pillow, they just put a couple of AA batteries.
Yeah, right. And actually, they have a real good attitude. When I went there, there were a few things I wanted to see, and I wasn't actually spending the night there. It's only about, 45 minutes west of where I live. So I had just stopped by to visit there in the course of doing some other things, and the people that were running the place were really very pleasant. I specifically asked to see a couple of rooms, one where there's believed to be a haunted, claw-footed bathtub, and they took me up to the room and let me examine
examine it and take pictures of a haunted bathtub. It was funny. When my wife and I walked into the hotel bar, the barmaid and one of the guests were actually discussing whether something that had just happened in the kitchen, whether it was caused by a ghost or not. Yeah, so the place is just widely considered to be haunted, and the people that run it don't promote it as such. If you go to their website, you're not going to find anything about ghosts on there, but they're very open, and that's kind of the balance I like, you know? A place that doesn't really promote that they're haunted, but doesn't try to keep it a secret or suppress it either.
Now, I have to ask, what does a haunted bathtub do?
My understanding is the feet kept falling off it when people would take baths in it. So it sure could be worse.
Okay. Wow.
Or like a badly constructed bathtub.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's it. But the room that the bathtub is in, strange things kept happening there. So a number of people were injured. No matter what else was going on in any of the rooms around it, it was in that room that things always seemed to go wrong, that there always seemed to be some sort of an issue. So the room ended up getting identified with... some sort of paranormal influence.
I thought maybe when you got into the bathtub, it would start walking around with the feet.
we can start studying that. We can say that. No, I don't think that happened. But you asked about the Emily Morgan, which was is downtown San Antonio. Yeah, that was built in the 1920s as the Medical Arts Building. And if you visit the Emily Morgan Hotel, it's a high rise. It's a 14-story building, 13-story, 14-story. If you visit the Emily Morgan and you walk around the ground floor of it on the outside, walk around the exterior of the building and look up, you can see these little gargoyles. And they're a tribute to when it was built as the Medical Arts Building, because they show people, little gargoyles, suffering from various medical maladies.
Really?
Yeah. And those are there even now, and people can see those. It's got a rich history, an incredible history. The pool, for example, was made from the stainless steel gurneys that had originally been in the morgue, in the Medical Arts Building.
Huh.
And those are the sorts of things people experience there. They'll smell a hospital-type smell on, the 14th floor, which is the core, or 13th, the 13th floor, which is labeled 14th floor. That's the floor where people experience things. That's where the operating rooms used to be in the Medical Arts Building, and where people experienced the most sorts of things.
Wow.
Now, before we... we'll be going to another break here in a little bit, but before we go, there's one that you talked about, the Comanche Lookout Park.
Yeah, that's an interesting site. There is a hill at the north of San Antonio, and it used to be called Comanche Lookout. And the reason it was called Comanche Lookout is because, not because people would go up there and keep an eye out for Comanches, but in the early days of San Antonio, that was used as a gathering point that Comanche warriors would meet, and they would hunt in the little river valleys and stream beds surrounding the Comanche Lookout, the hill. And they would launch ambushes from there. So from the top of Comanche Lookout, wagon trains that were coming from the east could be spotted a couple hours before they reached San Antonio. And then when they were just an hour or so out from San Antonio, they were subject to being attacked by Indians. So even as you were at the very gates of refuge, that's where it was most dangerous. So that's what the Comanche Lookout was. But what's striking about it is that today there's a medieval tower built on the summit of Comanche Lookout. And there's all sorts of stories that are associated with that tower. But the truth of the matter is it was built in the 1930s by a U.S. Army veteran who had served in World War I and seen European castles. And he bought the land that Comanche Lookout is located on, and tried to build a castle there. And all he really got completed was a tower, and then he lost his fortune, and the land had to be sold off. And his spirit is believed to be one of those that haunts the site because of his unfulfilled dream of building his dream home on the site.
So this was just more of a tower turret, not a keep or anything?
No, it's pretty much a tower. It's sort of a Norman-style tower, so it's probably 20 foot on the side, 20 foot square, and then three stories plus a roof. And I've got pictures of that. If you go to my site and you look up Comanche Lookout, or just look up Comanche, and some pictures of that tower will pop up.
So it's pretty interesting, too. We had somebody...
Was asking whether or not you think that the Indian spirits caused his fortune to disappear.
Well, that's certainly possible. Some of the most frightening manifestations that people have reported at Comanche Lookout, it's a place where a lot of people go to hike or jog. It's got a lot of paved trails, and there are a number of people, and this is reported by a couple of great ladies that run something called the Sisters Grimm Ghost Tours, Allison and Lauren Schwartz, and they live in San Antonio, and they're actually descendants of the original Canary Islanders that were the first colonists to settle in San Antonio. So this is part of their family legacy. But they've reported on people who have actually been chased by Indians at that site. But, you know, obviously not real Indians. There aren't real Indians in you know, war paint with weapons running around Comanche Lookout Hill anymore. These were, you know, ghosts, specters, whatever.
Now,
there's strong presence at that site.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Comanche Tower, and it reminds me a lot of what we have locally, which is the Loveland Castle. And it's almost the exact same story. It's a World War One vet who returned, but he fell in love with the castles in Europe, and he built his own castle. He got a little bit further along than this gentleman did at Comanche Lookout, but he also haunts his old castle too, and it's yet again another Norman style castle.
Yep. Yeah, and you know, when you actually explore the site, you'll find that there's the foundations of walls, and apparently there were some other buildings he had built. They looked more like garages or storage buildings. You know, maybe they were the first steps toward fulfilling his vision. So there are the remains of other things up there. Now, what's funny is this was all done in the 30s, and then by the 50s and 60s and 70s, all sorts of legends had sprung up. I mean, I read stuff from the 70s that refer to that tower as the old Spanish tower. So by the 70s, there were all sorts of legends that had sprung up that explained it. They're just completely wrong, completely untrue as to what this actually was. And when you really research that, but you know, there is a strange mystery, a mystery that I can't explain, and I've got my theories on it, but I ended up reading some of the archaeological reports of the archaeological surveys that were done at Comanche Lookout Park, and I've read plenty of government documents over the years. You know, I'm on who knows how many watch lists from having requested information about Area 51. I've read redacted government reports and documents before. I have never once before read a archaeological report compiled by a university that had redacted sections, that had blacked out censored sections in it. So there's something going on with that site that is so dark and so grim that it couldn't even be left for public consumption in an archaeological report.
Wow.
Now, speaking of walls, I have to ask this. Your opinion of the Great Texas Wall?
Now, what is the Great Texas Wall?
I believe it's down near you that they're trying to dig up. They say it's like a whole section, sort of like the Great Wall of China.
Man, you're a step ahead of me on this one. This is the first time I've heard the phrase Great Texas Wall in the context of anything but this asinine anti-immigration wall they're pretending to
no,
down on the border. No, this is news to me. I've never heard of the Great Texas Wall.
I shall have to find
it. You just having me on? Have my answers been so quick and so detailed and so forthcoming that you had to spring something on me just to see if I'm bullshitting you?
No.
CC is our local Perry Mason, you see, and you're on the.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that great Texas Varroa. It's like we call bullshit on you, Varroa. No, I've never heard of. I'm gonna have to look into that though.
Rockwell, Texas, I think is his.
Yeah, that's what Wikipedia says.
Yeah. Rockville, Texas?
Rockwell, Texas.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Next time we talk, I will have published the article on this, and I'll be able to tell you all about it.
I guess they were digging a well, and they came from rocks, and it looked like it was about 20 miles long, and it looked like a giant wall, sort of like the Wall of China was, but I don't know how wide it was, but it formed a rectangle around a city there.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. There were certainly city-building Native Americans, so it's not out of the question. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, before we take our last break, I'm going to give you one more that I wanted to find out about and why maybe it was haunted. It's at the Richard Moya Park, the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, why is it haunted? It's interesting. The bridge, Moore's Crossing Bridge at Richard Moya Park, and this is at the southeastern side of Austin, so it's just south of Bergstrom International Airport, which is the airport for Austin. It used to be the Congress Avenue Bridge. It used to be the bridge that crossed the Colorado River right next to the State House, next to the Texas State House. And it never had any stories of hauntings associated with it when it was there. And the bridge that currently crosses the Colorado River has a great bat emergence. 250,000 bats live under that bridge. And if you go there at twilight, any time except, the dead of winter, when the bats have migrated to Mexico, if you go there any time but the dead of winter, you can actually watch these 250,000 bats come out from under the bridge. And it takes about 10 minutes for all of them to come out. I have searched and searched and searched, and I cannot, I'm not saying there isn't any, but I haven't found it yet, I cannot find any stories of hauntings or ghostly lore or any paranormal activity associated with the current Congress Street Bridge. So as far as I can tell, whatever would have caused the bridge to become haunted in its current location is something that would have happened since it was re-erected there 100 years ago. And the best I can tell is it probably would have been a lynching, because the kinds of things that people report seeing there are a shadowy figure that looks like it's hanging or looks like it's hanging from a tree, a woman looking up at the body of someone hanging from a tree. That would be the cause behind that in all likelihood. And that's actually a site that I want to get out and do an investigation of, because the park is closed at night. Richard Moya Park closes at civil twilight, which I think is a very interesting phrase, but that general just means when the sun goes down. But there's a dirt road that leads up to the back of the park, whereby somebody could go up to the edge of the bridge and conduct an investigation there without actually being in the park. So I think that would be an interesting opportunity, and that's something I'm looking at doing, maybe with San Antonio Ghost Hunters, which is a great group that I've done some work with.
All right. I want to remind everybody that if you do have questions, you can private chat them to Ceiling Cat, Cat Paraview, Jeffrey Gould, or myself. We will get those questions right over to Michael. I think what we're going to do is going to go ahead and take our last break, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 minutes or so. So with that, Jeff's going to take us out, and Barbara will bring us back. So, Jeff?
Yes, you're listening to The Paranormal View at para-x.com with hosts Henry Foister, Kat Klokos, Ceiling Cat Barbara Duncan, and myself Jeffrey Gould, with our guest author Michael Varroa, discussing various San Antonio's Texas hauntings. So stay tuned for more Paranormal View after the break.
Rhett, where are you going?
I'm going back to the Paranormal View
back where I belong.
Please, please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs, and all kinds of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear...
Line!
Oh, you've got to be kidding.
Well, it's the Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Kat Kloko, and Barbara Duncan, every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
I found it at last! Marla's sacred cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron.
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more of your time, so I guess I'll be going.
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? Para-X Radio and the all-new Para-X Vision can help. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. Para-X Radio and Para-X Vision, programming for the open mind.
Hi, I am John Zaffis, and you are listening to Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.
Nine words women use. One.
Fine.
This is the word women use to end an argument when they are right and you need to shut up. Two.
5 minutes.
If she is getting dressed, this means a half hour. 5 minutes is only 5 minutes if you have just been given five more minutes to watch the game before helping around the house. Three.
Nothing.
This is the calm before the storm. This means something, and you should be on high alert. Arguments that begin with
nothing
usually end in
fine.
Four.
Go ahead.
Warning. Warning, Will Robinson. This is a dare, not permission. Don't do it. Five. This is actually a word, but it is a nonverbal statement often misunderstood by men. A loud sigh means that she thinks you are an idiot and wonders why she is wasting her time standing here arguing with you about nothing. Refer back to number three for the meaning of nothing. Six.
That's okay.
This is one of the most dangerous statements a woman can make to a man.
That's okay.
Means that she wants to think long and hard before deciding how and when you will pay for your mistake. Seven.
Thanks.
A woman is thanking you. Do not question or faint. Just say, you're welcome. Be careful. This is true unless she says,
thanks a lot.
That is pure sarcasm, and she is not thanking you at all. Do not say you're welcome if she says,
thanks a lot.
Or that will bring on,
whatever.
Eight.
Whatever.
This is the woman's way of saying,
fuck
you.
9.
Don't worry about it. I got it.
Another dangerous statement, meaning this is something that a woman has told a man to do several times, but is now doing it herself. This will later result in a man asking, what's wrong? For the woman's response, refer to number 3. And that is just 9 words women like to use.
Para-X Radio presents Real Persons of Genius.
Real Persons of Genius.
Today, we salute you, Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Armed with nothing more than a laptop and a microphone, you hit the air to scare the bejesus out of your audience.
What the hell was that noise?
Like a dog peeing on a fire hydrant, you always whet our appetite for more.
I just can't get enough.
Whether it's witches, ghosts, fairies, or Bigfoot, we admire your ability to set aside reality and believe anything anyone tells you.
Seek professional help.
So the next time you're kneeling in front of your 8x10 glossy of Dave and Tom lighting a candle, remember, if it wasn't for you, I might be able to sleep without the lights on.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X Soho.
Para-X Radio Network, powered by CBS.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal View here on Para-X Radio, and we're having a great conversation tonight with Michael Frijola, author of Ghost Hunting San Antonio, Austin, Texas Hill Country. Welcome back, everybody. And I have to ask, because this one really fascinates me, in your book you talk about the University of the Incarnate Word.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty fascinating site. That is a university that was founded as a hospital and a teaching school by nuns back in the 19th century. They were, 1800s. They were nuns that were part of the diocese in Galveston Island, and they were sent to San Antonio to establish a mission there. And it has got some pretty fascinating things associated with it. Some spiritual sites, one being the headwaters of the San Antonio River. So the source of the San Antonio River itself can be found right on the University of the Incarnate Word campus. So it's a very spiritual site. It's not probably coincidental that that the sisters decided, the Sisters of the Incarnate Word decided to establish their mission there.
Wow, that is interesting. And these sites always fascinate me in that with that much ritual going on there, through prayer, etc., that the energy level there would be different.
It would be.
It always,
yeah.
Always amazed me, though, that it would be haunted from the standpoint you look at where the faith is that you, when you die, you go to heaven, as opposed to hanging around a monastery.
Well, you know what? Laymen do not always have the tools for expressing the things that they're experiencing. So, and once again, like we said earlier on the show, if you're looking for ghosts, ghosts are what you're going to find. So I would postulate that there is a spiritual presence at the University of the Incarnate Word, but maybe it isn't really ghosts as we know it. Maybe it is some sort of spiritual presence that predates when anything was actually built there. Now, that said, in the main building of University of Incarnate Word, the main administration building, used to have a tuberculosis ward in it, and there are people who've experienced, have seen ghosts, have seen apparitions of what look like 19th century children who are dying of consumption. So, you know, that's not going to be explained by primordial spiritual presences associated with the headwaters of the river. So people have actually seen things there that that go beyond that. But, you know, Shakespeare said it better than anyone in Hamlet. There are more things in this world that can be found in your philosophy. It's just too hard to try to explain everything with any one ethos or religion or point of view. So yeah, right. The people who founded that university said, when you die, if you're a good person, you go to heaven, and if you're a bad person, you go to hell. And there are things that happen there that aren't necessarily explained by that, but that's just the way these things are.
Well, yeah, even through ritual, you know, you're going to be raising energy up, and I'm sure it stays there, especially if that's where there's a water source.
Yeah.
That's not going to dissipate very fast.
No, that's exactly right. And you know, nuns and clergy, they're people too, and they experience all sorts of emotions. And all of the sisters who have died there in the last 150 years are buried there now. There's actually a cemetery there. So, you know, we can't forget that. They died and they were buried and they experienced things in their life and left behind a spiritual imprint and spiritual energy. So it's a neat site to visit, though. It's not a huge campus. It's not a particularly big campus. And there are several spiritually charged sites that someone can visit or investigate, all in close proximity to each other. The cemetery where the sisters are buried is at one end of the campus, and then the at the eastern end, and then at the western end is the Blue Hole, and the Blue Hole is this well that is the headwaters of the San Antonio River, and only seasonal now. Waters used to come up from it year round, but the water table is so heavily taxed in San Antonio anymore because there are so many people there. It's the 11th biggest, seventh biggest city in the country, that water only flows seasonally up out of the Blue Hole now.
Wow.
So, but yeah, University of Incarnate Word is definitely worth a visit. It's a beautiful campus. Go doing it during a break. That's what I would tell people, you know, when there's not a lot of students around, so you're not being disruptive and so that people aren't disrupting you. There's a famous place that people will go on pilgrimages to in Europe called Lourdes. And there is a replica of the Lord's Sanctuary on the University of the Incarnate Word campus.
Wow.
Yeah, so fascinating stuff.
Now,
but it's spiritually charged. You'll feel that if you're there, I would venture to say.
There was another place there that I thought was older than a lot of the other places, called the Spanish Governor's Palace.
That is one of the first places that was built in San Antonio. It's not older than the Alamo, because the missions were the very, very first places that were built. So the Spanish Governor's Palace is one of the oldest buildings in San Antonio, and it was originally built as the Presidio. So when it was built, it wasn't the home or the headquarters for the Spanish governor. It was the Presidio, which is to say the military headquarters. So it was the arsenal and the military headquarters for that area. And it was built not far from the Alamo, so from the Alamo mission, so that it could militarily support it. And then eventually it became... was expanded, and it became the residence for the Spanish governor. And it has a lot of tumultuous and violent history associated with it. It was subjected to Indian attack any number of times, and the people had to hold themselves in and fend off attack for as long as was necessary. Some children died there over the years, and their bodies were found, at least one, in the well behind the Spanish Governor's Palace. So the ghosts of children are associated with that site. And there's a tree in the courtyard next to the palace where people used to be hanged when they were convicted of capital crimes. So there's quite a bit of bloodshed associated with the site, from combat, judicial execution, and bad fortune on the part of the children who died there.
Well, that's what happens when Lassie wasn't around.
Yeah, well, that's right.
What about Rin Tin Tin?
He never asked, told anybody Timmy was in a well.
Cece, yep. Where do we have listeners at?
The United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom.
No, all over.
All over the place.
Yeah, we got them from all over. Not as all over as we're used to, but they're still from all over.
Yeah, where did Unknown go? Did it just fly off to Jupiter or something?
Well, yeah, one never knows.
One thing I want to mention about these places that we're talking about tonight, about every site that I write about in Ghost Hunting San Antonio, Austin, Texas Hill Country, every site that we cover in all of the America's Haunted Road Trip books. And I've written a Ghost Hunting Virginia. I've written a Ghost Hunting Maryland. As soon as I get done with this book, I have to fly out to Washington, D.C. and get started on Ghost Hunting Washington, D.C.
Really?
Yes, sir. These are all publicly accessible sites.
That so it would be
except the White House. I mean, well, it's tours, but... You know,
well, did I say I was going to include the White House?
That's
pretty
much and it's pretty haunted.
Well, it is haunted, and I will be including it.
The Lincoln bedroom,
Madison's Road Garden.
Okay, so all the sites we include are more or less publicly accessible. But the point is, I don't have any chapters that say, outside of the village of Wimberley, there's a dirt road, and if you go down it to the end, there's a house there. And there, now, I mean, there are so many books like this. There are so many books that you can find that are supposedly, you know, the haunted history of such and such a state or town or area, and they're full of unactionable information. All they are is these vague legends, and they're deliberately written to keep you from being able to go and actually investigate them and run them down. So, you know, like I said, I'm not in the business of convincing anyone of anything. If I say a place is haunted and you don't believe in ghosts, well, that's fine. I'm not going to try to convince you it's really haunted. My job isn't to try to make people believe things they don't believe. What I am writing and what I am editing, the series I'm editing and the series I'm writing books for, these are travel guides. These are travel guides to reputedly haunted places that people can visit. So every place we include has got an appendix listing that gives you its hours and its website and its address so that you can run a Google map and know when to go there and visit it yourself. So that's what we're writing. We're telling you sites that you can go to and investigate on your own. Not private houses, not hospitals, not elementary schools. You know, we're not writing about places we don't want to be sending people. These are our places that...
Hostown Elementary is technically a school, but...
Sure.
It's not a school anymore.
No.
Exactly. So that's what... I just want to make that clear that all the places that we're talking about, all the places that I'm including in Ghost Hunting San Antonio, are places that people can actually go to and visit on their own. And I think that's very important. You know, that's what makes these books useful tools that people can actually use as springboards for their own investigation. I always give the real history, the haunted history, and then what I experienced when I was boots on the ground. And I visit them all. You know, I visit them all if for no other reason than so that I'll know they actually absolutely really exist. I can vouch that these places really exist and that you can really, really visit them.
That's so, what makes it the most credible is when you're writing and doing things like that is actually go to the places, do your own. And I don't mean necessarily investigating, but you're there, you can look at it, you have the real information that you can actually put in.
And you're legally going to these places, not trespassing and then writing about it.
Right.
Yeah, and the problem with that is not that you can't get into a place that you're not supposed to be in and write about it. You know, there's something to be said for that. I've done the investigation in the Paris catacombs, and we actually had to evade the police to get into that. That was a big deal. So yeah, I've gone into places I wasn't supposed to go into, but I'm not going to write about them in a travel guide.
No.
Yeah, I think we've all sort of done the slight trespassing-y kind of thing at one point or another.
Yeah, it's what Carl Kolchak on Night Stalker used to call The Midnight Interview. I always liked that. What we used to call the Midnight Interview, and then they'd show him knocking out the glass on a window with a flashlight.
Nice.
Now, there's one place that I want to talk about, and what happened there took place, what, 40 years ago, 50 maybe? The University of Texas Tower.
Oh, that took place in 1966.
Right.
And that was when Charles Whitman took a footlocker, mounted it on a handcart dolly, and took it up to the 30th floor observation deck of the University of Texas Tower and began sniping at people. He began shooting people on the campus and on the city streets below with a footlocker full of weapons that he hauled up there with him. So that is what happened there. And if you go there today, you can take a tour. It's interesting. You can go to the University of Texas Tower and you can take a tour there, and it has security on par with a regional airport. You cannot take any bags with you. You got to check them in a locker before you go through the metal detector, which is attended by two armed state policemen. And then once you go through the metal detector down a hallway and accompanied by tour guides, go up to the tower. You get off on the 27th floor. There's another armed state policeman. You walk up to the 30th floor, and there's yet another armed state policeman. So the level of security is striking. But then sort of counterposed with that is that they will not discuss the 1966 incident in any way. They do not mention it or allude to it or answer questions about it at all on the tour.
I know,
even though their presence sort of does that, I would think.
Yeah.
With that?
I would think their presence being there would sort of hint
at it. Well, you know what? Anyone who is coming of age after 9/11 takes a lot of this kind of crap for granted. Anybody who's of college age, they are not going, you know, an old fart like me is going to go there and they're going to say, oh my God, why is there so much security for a tower on the main administration building of a college campus? I'm going to question that. But anyone younger than me is not necessarily going to question that, and increasingly people don't question things like that. I'd venture to say that most of the people who take the tour, I'd say that half the people who take the tour take it because they already know the history of the tower, and that's why they're there.
Right.
And the other half, it never even occurs to them to wonder why the security would be that level.
Now
that actually scares me more than any concept of ghost or demon.
Well, there are these things. Certainly, there are scary things on different levels. Different kinds of scary things on different levels.
You know,
yeah.
To me, it's the loss of liberty and the loss of freedom is what's terrifying to me.
You know, I think there's a copycat out there looking at that, going, "Hey, what a good idea!"
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe you could shoot up.
I'm interested in knowing, is there the same, have you visited the Texas Book Depository?
Years ago I did. I'm not covering that in the book that I'm writing now because that's North Texas. Dallas is about 300 miles north of me.
Yeah.
So it's way out of the area that I'm covering. But yeah, I've been to Dealey Plaza and the Texas Book Depository. And it was kind of fun. The day I visited Texas Book Depository, it was about 12 years ago, and I was with a friend of mine who was a DEA agent. So it was kind of fun for him to go up to the guards and whisper in their ear that he had a gun and show his badge so that he could walk around the metal detector and get into the book depository while keeping his firearm on him. I thought that was kind of fun to actually be in the book depository with someone who had a firearm with them.
So it had the same type of security.
There you have it. Exactly so.
Yeah, wow, yeah. I often wonder whether or not the grassy knoll area outside there and the road that the president traveled had any sort of activity on it as well.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I did not conduct any sort of an paranormal investigation when I was up there. I did come across something kind of weird and interesting a few years back. I wrote a book called Texas Confidential: Sex, Scandal, Murder, and Mayhem in the Lone Star State. And once in a while, somebody will ask me, "Oh, what's it about?" And I'll say, "Sex, scandal, murder, mayhem."
Yeah, really. Look at our time, man.
But it's a 52 chapter history of just iniquity in Texas. And one of the chapters in it is called Crime of the Century. And it's about a man who was convicted murderer. He had been convicted of murder twice, I believe, and sent to prison. And he got out of prison in the 1970s, in the early 1970s. He was a contract killer. His name was Charles Void Harrelson, and I've always thought that was a particularly creepy middle name. You know, it's a very nihilistic name, Void. He was hired by a drug cartel in the 1970s. I said early 70s, and it was later, mid to late 70s. Hired by a drug cartel to kill a federal judge. And it was called the Crime of the Century because this was the first time in the 20th century that a federal judge was murdered, and by a contract killer. It was a big deal. So he killed a judge in San Antonio called John J. Wood, and the federal courthouse in downtown San Antonio is the John J. Wood Federal Courthouse now. But there was this massive investigation. Actually, more time and money went into this investigation than into the Kennedy assassination, believe it or not, just in terms of dollars and manpower. And eventually, the state police tracked this guy down. He was running a load of cocaine from El Paso to Houston, and they stopped him off of I-10 near a town called Van Horn. And he stood in the highway with a .357 Magnum held to his head, threatening to blow his brains out, completely strung out on coke, yelling, "I shot Kennedy, I shot Kennedy, I shot Kennedy." Well, what's really weird, two things are weird, the whole damn thing is weird, but a couple things are particularly weird. One is that anyone who studied this knows about the three tramps, the three hobos that were found hiding in a boxcar near Dealey Plaza. He's one of them. He was one of them. One of the pictures of the three tramps that the police took is of Charles Void Harrelson. That is one of the interesting things. And then the other interesting thing is that he's Woody Harrelson's dad.
Woody Harrelson's dad?
Yeah. Actor Woody Harrelson's dad. Actor, if you read anything about Woody Harrelson, you'd hear how his father abandoned the family and his mother moved to Ohio with him and his brother. That's the father. Charles Void Harrelson is Woody Harrelson's father. And Woody Harrelson actually spent quite a bit of time trying to get his father retried so that he could have him released from Leavenworth, where he was sentenced. And then his father died of some kind of cancer several years back, and all those efforts ended. But that's one of the driving forces behind natural born killers. Harrelson's wondering, do these things, pass from generation to generation, from one family member to another?
Wow. I know he's from Lebanon, right up here, just mm-hmm. up from me. So.
Well, he's originally from Texas. He and his mother, and he and his brother moved there. I think when he was maybe 10. I could be wrong about that, but when he was young.
Wow.
So, yeah, so interesting crossover between, the whole Kennedy thing, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, now, has anyone ever tried to do any kind of investigating the limousine where Kennedy was killed and see if there's any, energy?
I don't know. I have to admit that I tend to investigate Just the things that somehow tie in with a project that I'm working on. You know, it's all the time people will say to me, "Oh, well, have you ever been up to Gettysburg?" Well, yeah, I've been to Gettysburg, but I have to say I'm not really interested in doing an investigation at Gettysburg because it's been so written about because somebody else already wrote Ghost Hunting Pennsylvania. It's mostly the things that I'm involved with. Yeah, I've only got so much time. I've only got so much energy. If it isn't something that ties in with a project that I'm either publishing, editing, or writing, I probably haven't done it. So I'm really a South Texas, Central Texas kind of guy at this point. I am going to be doing it. You're asking good questions because one of the books I want to do coming up is a Ghost Hunting Dallas, and that'll cover North Texas for us, and then a Ghost Hunting Houston, and that'll cover East Texas for us. So I'd like to this Ghost Hunting San Antonio, Austin, and Texas Hill Country is pretty intensive. We're really covering this area in a lot of detail. It's very comprehensive, and I'd like to do the same thing with Dallas and the same thing with Houston, and that will really give us a nice statewide coverage.
Well, that's great. Of course, everybody in chat room's already been hollering that they want you back. So the only thing that I can suggest is write faster.
Yeah, boy, my publisher keeps telling me that, too. I'll tell you what. Well, good. If people want me back, that's good. I know I get a little manic on these things. I try to cycle my manic phase to when the show is on because the depressive phase is only worse. So if I seem a little ramped up, it's because, better that than the alternative.
So, well, there's a couple other places. Got time for one or two more real quick, like, I guess. Excuse me.
I'll try to answer them quickly instead of giving an exposition, if y'all prefer that.
Well, now you had another one that you had some pictures of. I thought looked pretty neat. Was the haunted Black Swan Inn?
Oh yeah, Victoria's Black Swan Inn. That is on the site of the Battle of Salado Creek. So even after Texas became independent, Mexico tried to recapture it a couple of times. So up into the 1840s, there were a number of border wars between the Texas Republic and Mexico. And Victoria's Black Swan Inn is an event venue that is located on the site of that battle. And the ghosts of soldiers who were killed in that battle, just one Texan, but about 60 Mexicans, those are among the things that have been encountered there. And the house itself has some real, real dark presences in it. And it's actually been the series of a number of ghost hunting documentaries. So it is considered to be one of the most haunted sites in South Texas. And I've been out there. I've done an investigation there. That was actually the first thing I ever did with this group, San Antonio Ghost Hunters. I had corresponded with some of them and looked at videos of some of their investigations. And then I went out and met them at Victoria's Black Swan Inn earlier this year and spent the night there with them doing an investigation. And it's just a haunted site. They were picking up audio, voices, speaking the names of the investigators, voices, spectral voices, you know, that were inaudible but were being recorded, that were using profanity. It was crazy. Yeah, they were just picking up all sorts of just really extreme crazy stuff, and they always do. It's just a really, really haunted site.
Now, is that the area where the Sisters Grimm ghost tours are done?
Our Sisters Grimm ghost tours are right downtown. So the Sisters Grimm will usually meet at the Menger Hotel. And sometimes they'll even do a dinner in conjunction with the tour. So I did one of their tours about a year ago, and we had dinner at the Menger Hotel and then started with the Menger. So we went to the Roy Rogers room. We went to the King Ranch room. These are rooms that are believed to be haunted in the Menger. And then from there, we went to about a half dozen other sites throughout downtown San Antonio.
Now, there's one other place that you had listed in there that supposedly had been a ghost town for about, I don't know, 20, 30 years before they brought it back. And it's the Gruen Historic District.
It's Green. It's actually pronounced Green. It's G-R-U-E-N-E. And, of course, that's German, Grüne, which means green. So they spell it Grüne, but because we're Texans, we pronounce it Green. But, yeah, that's an old mill town. It was more or less a ghost town. It never completely shut down. There's something there called Green Hall, which is the oldest continuously operated dance hall in Texas. And people can visit that, go listen to music there almost any day in the summer or on weekends. So I don't know if Green Hall is haunted, but there's a bed and breakfast right next door to it. That's believed to be haunted. There's a great restaurant. If you go there, you should eat at the Grist Mill. It's the first place in South Texas that I ever ate, and it's terrific. The first place, you know, in Comal County, I should say. It is haunted, and people have experienced things there, including ghosts that play with the appliances and start fires. So that's worth a visit. There's a place called Adobe Verde, which is a Mexican restaurant there. It's reputed to be haunted as well. So Green is an interesting place. Real touristy, and not necessarily open to investigations. Some of the places we've talked about today, you can pretty easily go in and conduct an investigation. In Green, you know, go there, enjoy the ambiance, and if you can do something surreptitious, do. But do not expect a lot of welcome when it comes to that sort of thing. And they don't respond to correspondence if it mentions paranormal or ghosts or supernatural at all. They just don't want to have anything to do with it.
Huh. Bunch of freaky cats.
Yeah, you never know why people react the way they do. I interviewed a woman who ran a historical site in Maryland, and, you know, she's a nice woman, and it was a great site, but she really honestly did not understand the difference between paranormal investigators. I mean, this is true. It sounds stupid, but she did not understand the difference between paranormal investigators and black cloak Satanists with pentagrams tattooed on their chest. She just didn't understand that there was a difference between these two classes of people. And she was convinced that if her place was identified as being haunted, these Satanists would inexplicably come and burn it down. How do you argue with that? What are you supposed to say?
I don't see why Satanists would burn anything down apart from, like, hey, we got a nice place to hang out.
Exactly. So, once she had explained that to me, I did the best I could. And then I ended up including it in my book. I think I convinced her, you know, enough. It's one of the sites in my ghost hunting Maryland. So it's there. The damn thing still hasn't been burned down. So...
Well, I've got about 3 minutes before we start wrapping everything up here, but I got one other one. If we go back to Bourne, it's the
Bernie,
the mansion in Bernie.
Oh yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. That place has always been known as the mansion. It was built, you know, like many of these places, mid-19th century. It was really the 1840s and 50s that mostly German immigrants began settling the area we now know as Hill Country. So lots and lots of Germans. That's why there's a lot of German names in these towns. But today, the mansion is La Mansión, and it's a Mexican restaurant, a very good traditional Mexican restaurant. But it is believed to be haunted by at least three ghosts. One, a orphan teenager who is believed to have been killed when he got kicked in the head by a horse. His spirit is often encountered in a particular room on the upper level. A woman who had lived there at one point and seemed to have had an unhappy life in some ways. Her spirit has encountered another room on the upper level. And then there's a ghost named Fred that's encountered particularly in the basement. And I'm actually in the process of trying to line up an investigation, a formal overnight investigation with one of the groups I work with sometime after the new year there. So maybe I'll have some fresh things to report on it. But in the meantime, you know, they're pretty open about letting people wander around, and you can get a good lunch or dinner there.
That sounds excellent. Well, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us tonight. And I want you to stay on until after we're off. We'll thank you properly. But right now, why don't you give out all your books, your site, and how to get your books and all the good stuff?
Okay. If anyone would like to check out the site for Ghost Hunting San Antonio, Austin, and Texas Hill Country, it's at ghosthunting-san-antonio.blogspot.com. ghosthunting-san-antonio.blogspot.com. So that's the site for Ghost Hunting San Antonio, Austin, and Texas Hill Country. I'm on Facebook. On Facebook, I am Michael O. Varhola. So I'm the only Michael O. Varhola on Facebook, so I'm easy to find. There's also an author Michael O. Varhola page. So if somebody actually wants to get to know me, they can go to Michael O. Varhola. And if they don't really want to get to know me, but they want to follow what I'm up to, they can go to author Michael O. Varhola. And then there's the America's Haunted Road Trip page on Facebook, and that has got just a lot of information about all of the projects that the America's Haunted Road Trip is involved with. So people can check that out.
And where can I get your books at?
Amazon.com. If you go to Amazon.com and you search against Michael Varhola, if you see a Michael J. Varhola, that's me. If you see a Michael O. Varhola, that's me. I legally changed my name some years back, so my middle name is now O instead of J. But we're the same person. If you see a Michael H. Varhola, that's not me. My father co-authored a book with me some years back. So my father's Michael H., and I'm Michael O. and Michael J.
All right.
Jeff? So apart from the orange juice reference, what do the middle initials each stand for?
You know, there is no orange juice reference or O.J. Simpson reference or anything else. The J was James. I was named after a grandfather who never really liked me. And finally, I just said, why would my parents name me after someone who disliked me? Apparently, that didn't adequately curry favor with him. So some years back, I got an email message about a family reunion that everyone was at, and it was wonderful, and it was terrific. And everyone in the family, like 30 of them, had gotten together for Christmas in San Antonio. I said, what the hell? I live in San Antonio. And apparently everyone didn't include me or my wife. And I said, what the hell with this? I'm not keeping this guy's name anymore. So I changed it, and I knew I was going to change my name, and I had to pick a name that sort of exemplified what I wanted my life to be like. You know, it's a big decision to change your name. You don't want to do it more than once. My favorite book is The Odyssey. And my favorite hero is Odysseus, so O is Odysseus because that is the name that I chose to set the tone for the rest of my life moving forward.
Excellent. Ooh. Well, everybody, you can go to my website, which is jeffgould.net, jeffgould.net. And if you add /2011pnv.htm, that's my Paranormal View web hub page, where you can see previous reports and links to all of Michael's different sites that he's talking about, his books you can get on the podcast will be embedded there. On the official website for the show is theparanormalview.com. The show is also on Twitter, which Cattle mentioned. I'm on Twitter at Real Badger, and thanks to Sarge in the chat room, who is my official 1300th follower on Twitter. When I get up to 2,000 followers, Twitter's algorithm will allow me to follow back more than the 2,000 I'm already limited to follow. So I'm also on Facebook, so is Paranormal View. Just look us up. WeCommunity.magazine, and there you go. Have a great weekend.
Kat?
Okay, you can follow the Paranormal View on Twitter at Paraview Radio. You can also follow me at Kat Cloco or my webcomic at Jinxed Comic. You can check out my personal website, www.katcloco.com. That's KatKlocko.com.
And
we're all friends with each other, I think, aren't we?
Yep, we are. We're tagging each other all day today.
Yep.
I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. Next week, we'll be doing our Christmas show, so come and join all the fun with that. Until then, this is Henry Foister,
Jeffrey Gould,
Barbara Duncan,
and Kat Cloco,
and Michael Varola.
And we will see you all next week. Good night, everybody.
The Paranormal View. The Paranormal View. The Paranormal View. The Paranormal View. Come back and listen to us again, if you dare. The Paranormal View from the Power X Radio Network. The Paranormal.